Hey, everybody, and welcome to episode 11
of
The Good, the Bad, and the Wretched. I know. I didn't think of any other way to start it. My name is Chris. With me is Josh.
Hello.
The naysayer of my awooing skills.
Yeah, well, it's become this kind of bit at the beginning.
I want to become Warren Zevon. I want to do my Werewolves of London.
That's good. Yeah, I watched the video for that last night.
Did you really?
I did.
Anyway,
welcome, Warren Zevon.
Welcome to episode 11 of Good, Bad, and the Wretched. After a nice little 3-week break, we're back. Hopefully you were able to not curl in a ball and cry in our absence.
Yeah. I think people were really upset that we were missing.
I think they probably were. If you haven't guessed by my skillful baying, this episode is about werewolves. And first of all, we're going to talk about what we've been up to. So why don't you kick us off there, Josh?
Me? Okay. Well, I guess been up to a few things. Part of the reason for the delay is that I had to go to Toronto for a week for work. But as I was there, there was a exhibition on Stanley Kubrick movies.
Yeah, I saw photos of that. It looks pretty sweet.
It was pretty sweet. They had a room for each movie, and they had production stills, and they had scenes from the movie playing, and there was some just some facts, and then there were some props.
How many of his movies did they cover?
Every movie.
Even like
from Killer's Kiss to Eyes Wide Shut.
Really?
Yeah. And then they even had stuff on his unfinished movies, like Napoleon and his take on AI.
Well, that's cool.
It was really cool. And I always get excited when I get to see movie props. I like film used movie props up close and personal. So it was really neat to see the axes from The Shining and the Star Child from 2001 and Alex's cane from Clockwork Orange. So it was really cool.
I always said that it was too bad that he died before he could actually make AI over Spielberg, because I think it would have been a way better movie.
Yeah, I mean, the Spielberg one's not very memorable to me. The thing I remember about AI is I remember there being a specific point near in the final act
when it's supposed to end,
where I was like, this would have been a perfect ending. Yeah, that they
you have
going.
The exact same scene I'm thinking of, and it involves water, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally.
Yes.
Does.
Okay, so we agree.
Why did they do that?
Yeah,
it was so perfect.
I was this is the best ending, and then it kept going for another 20 minutes.
Yeah,
and
totally.
I was like, what are you doing, Steve?
So I don't know if Kubrick would have done that. I think he would have ended there.
Probably, hopefully,
after 50,000 takes.
Probably. But yeah, what was the highlight then for props and stuff?
I'd say the Shining room was a highlight. I mean, they had, like, the cool thing was that they weren't all encased in glass. Like, Jack's typewriter from The Shining was like right there.
Could you actually touch it, or did they have barriers
around
it?
Well, it said please do not touch, but it was like right there. It was like a museum in Europe or something.
Right.
Some things were in glass, like they had the little girls from The Shining's dresses.
Right.
Those were behind glass. But for the most part, it was right out in the open. Now, there were some replica things there. Like, they had some statues from, the Milk Bar and Clockwork Orange. And I don't believe those were originals, but it was still pretty cool. Like, it was just a really cool atmosphere.
I just like the pictures you were showing me earlier today. I liked the room 237 doors.
Yeah, that's, and the carpet, too.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was really neat. And it gave me, a different appreciation. I mean, we all know what a mastermind Kubrick was. I've never really loved his movies, but I really love Spartacus, and I really love The Shining, and I think the other ones, I love them more the more I see them.
Well, except Dr. Strangelove is totally underrated.
Yeah,
and I really appreciate Clockwork Orange a lot more now than when I did when I was a teenager when I originally saw it. And I think that's because in high school we kind of read the book and we had to slog through that Anthony Burgess's really dense languages, and it was hard to fathom. And I feel like when it's in motion on screen, it was a lot easier to kind of get an idea of what he was talking about when he uses his terms like droogs and all that stuff. Like, visually, it was able to tie the language to visuals, which made it a little bit easier for me, because I found the book was kind of very difficult when we were in high school trying to read it.
And Kubrick's movies are all pretty difficult. I mean, my favorite is probably The Shining, because I think it's probably the most straightforward, and Spartacus.
Yeah.
But some of the other ones I have
a little
Barry
harder
Lyndon
time. Too.
I haven't seen Barry Lyndon.
Oh, okay. Barry Lyndon's good. But The Shining, it starts with that, over the mountains shot that follows the the VW Bug as they head up to the Overlook.
Yeah.
And that shot alone, that establishing shot tells you what you're in for. Like, it's going to be a visual treat. And it was. I mean, I remember we saw The Shining about 3 years ago. We went to a place in Seattle, Washington. It's kind of like a dinner theater kind of place where you can order pizza and beer and all that at your table while you're watching a movie. And they did The Shining.
Nice.
And it was exciting to see that. But I felt embarrassed because we had spent the entire day running around Seattle and doing the touristy kind of things, you know, going to Pike Place Market, going to Pioneer Square.
Right.
And we ended up being so tired by the time they played the movie, which was at 10 p.m., that we could feel ourselves dozing off while the movie's playing.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, I hope people around aren't looking at us saying, look at those two losers falling asleep during such an awesome movie.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there's a reason that I've bought that movie numerous times.
Yeah.
Because it is his masterwork, probably. I mean, people might disagree with us, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people regard 2001 and Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah.
I think his movies are... You know, you have to watch them more than once to appreciate. And it's stuff I learned at the exhibit, like, you know, Barry Lyndon, he lit the movie with candles. So he actually did that because there's a lot of scenes with candles, from my understanding. And like, they had some of the candles they used in the movie, and they were actually had three wicks on them, so they'd burn brighter.
Oh, really?
So just little cool things like that I found really neat. And they had a bunch of his cameras there too, and lenses, and it was quite the immersive experience.
Clapboard, you said too.
Yeah. Apparently the TIFF Lightbox, the Toronto International Film Festival Lightbox, that's like the center for the Toronto International Film Festival. So there's a whole bunch of movie theaters in there. But apparently they do exhibits like this all the time. They've had like a Tim Burton one. They had a Bowie one. So pretty neat. It's a pretty neat idea. And
I would have liked to have seen the Bowie one.
Me too.
Especially if they had his sweet labyrinth costume with that with that friggin' jock cup and everything.
Yeah.
I would just be in there singing that magic dance song from Labyrinth if I went to that exhibit. You remind me of the babe. What babe? The babe with the power. What power? Anyway, that's enough.
Tangent.
That's enough.
Anyway, I'd go back there. Like, every time I go to Toronto now, I'll be checking out what's going on down there, because it was really worth going to. So anyway, back to movies I've seen. So one cool thing that happened also on the way to Toronto is I was on the airplane, and one of the selections was Bride of Frankenstein, which I haven't seen in a while. So I watched it.
Woman.
it was really cool, though. Like, it was really nice to be able to see.
That's weird.
Bride of Frankenstein on a
plane.
You
weren't even going in October and it was a choice.
I know.
How many choices did they give you?
There was tons of choices.
Really? I thought airplanes, I haven't been on an airplane in a long time that actually has shown a movie, because I haven't traveled that long of enough of a flight.
Yeah.
I didn't know you could actually pick what you wanted to watch.
Maybe it's Air Canada as opposed to WestJet, but they had, like a whole, like, you could pick a genre. Well, like, you could pick like new releases or classics.
Huh.
And then there was about, in the new releases, there was a whole bunch of choices. In the classics, there was about 10, I'd say, 15 maybe. And then they had contemporary classics. So they had The Shining, ironically.
I wonder if they're edited, though.
I don't know. I mean, I watched Bride of Frankenstein on the way there, and then I watched a Charlie Chaplin movie, Modern Times, on my way back, because I've never seen a Chaplin movie. Well, I gotta say, I also really loved that too. I didn't think I would, but holy crap, I can see why it's in like the top 50 movies of all time.
He was funny.
He was funny, and just the production design and just the stuff he was doing back in the 30s was pretty cool.
Which one is Modern Times?
He's like this factory worker at the beginning, and then he gets thrown in jail.
Is that the one where he eats his shoe, or is that a different one?
I'm not sure. I didn't actually get to the end.
Oh, okay.
But I did watch most of it, and there was the girl in it was really beautiful, and I think it was actually his wife at the time, but just there was this roller skating scene in this department store, and it was just awesome. And yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing the end of that, and also watching The Gold Rush and some of his other movies.
Cool.
So what else have I watched? The Island, Michael Caine,
Peter Benchley
pirate movie. Yeah.
Yar.
So I always remember this one because it had a really awesome cover in the video stores, and I think on the book too. And it was like this dagger, tattooed hand holding a dagger, like popping out of the water in front of this yacht. Looked really menacing. I always thought it was a horror movie, but
it was always in the horror movie section.
Yeah, it was more like an adventure B movie, but I don't know. It's one of these ones. Scream Factory's or Shout Factory's Scream Factory, I think,
Scream Factory
put it out recently.
Same thing.
Well, in the last few years. And on Blu-ray. So I decided to pick it up. And, yeah, I mean, it doesn't have a very good reputation. I didn't hate it. I wasn't watching it going end. But I also don't know if I'd go back to it. But it had a few moments, like we talked about earlier, where it... kind of shocking.
Well, yeah, from what we were talking about, because we were talking about The Island briefly before we started recording, is you kind of gave me the opinion, your opinion was kind of like indifferent towards it. You said it's one of those movies that's moments more than an actual movie, where the plot's not really that engaging apart from these moments here and there. And I've always kind of been curious about the movie, but now you've kind of saved me from plunking down the $20 for the Blu-ray, because it doesn't sound like something I might want to hold on to if I ever saw it. I could just borrow your copy one day.
Yeah, I mean, the big problem with it I found was that the pirates didn't really have personalities. Like, David Warner's like the lead pirate, and he had a little bit of one, but the rest of them all kind of blended together. And like, I mean, it was kind of neat because they like had developed their, they were using language that they would have used in like the 1700s. So from that perspective, it was kind of cool, and they obviously had put effort into doing this, but it just, yeah, they all kind of blended together. The best part was when they, like, attacked this giant schooner that these, like, drug-running, like, yuppie disco guys and a few girls are, like, on, and the pirates board it and start, like, killing everyone. But then this one dude, he's, like, got, like, kind of puffy 70s hair and...
short shorts.
Really, like, a bathing suit, and he starts doing kung fu, like, full on with, like, Bruce Lee, like, you know, sounds. Exactly. And the pirates are, like, just laughing at him and attacking him one by one.
Man,
it was pretty funny.
Every time we bring up kung fu on boats, I just always think of Raw Force, though, so I don't know how I could handle
it. Exactly. It wasn't like Raw Force, but it was entertaining for a few minutes. And then the ending, I'm not going to spoil it, but the ending was definitely came out of nowhere, and I was really surprised by it. But and the kid's really good, too. There's this child actor that plays Kane's, I guess he's around 12 or 13 years old. Only movie this kid ever did, but I thought he really did a pretty great job, and I'm really surprised that was the only movie he did.
So but, how does that compare to the other Benchley one, The Deep?
Well, The Deep has Jacqueline Bisset in that white t-shirt, I don't really know what to say about that. Actually, I haven't seen The Deep.
Oh, okay.
But it does have that, and it does have Robert Shaw, so... I would imagine it's probably better than this, but okay. I know that's got a bad rep as well, right?
I didn't love it, but like you said, Jacqueline Bisset in a wet t-shirt and Nick Nolte looking all a little bit crazy.
Yeah, and was Jacqueline Bisset at her prime.
It had some pretty sweet underwater diving scenes, if I remember correctly. I haven't seen it in a while.
Yeah, I mean, The Deep looks like it would be a nice movie to look at. And this one, it could have been. It would just, a lot of it just was stuck in this, like, pirate camp. So you weren't really getting a lot of the scenery. Yeah, it was all right. You know, check it out, but don't break your back trying to watch it.
Josh gives it an indifferent shrug.
I've also been continuing my Friday the 13th.
Binge-a-thon,
but I've slowed it down quite a bit. Now,
are you planning on watching the 2009 remake as well as part of
this?
Yeah,
I'm going to go through them all.
Oh, okay.
But I did manage to watch part three, and I will say, yes, you're correct, Chris.
Yes!
There was no one in a wheelchair in it, but the lead actor was such a loser that... not that people in wheelchairs are losers, but he did... He just was totally ineffective.
Who's the main guy?
So
Shelley?
He might as well have been.
What? Was it that Shelley guy who was the main actor?
No, he was like a side actor. This Shelley was this like really annoying.
The horror movie,
he like had a makeup kit and he tried to, and he was just really annoying. He was like this chubby guy and
but
couldn't get laid. And
Shelley's the reason Jason got that hockey mask.
He is. And you know what? If the guy just kept his mouth shut, I think he was going to get laid in the movie, but he just kept talking and he talked himself out of the situation. Dude, I do remember the bikers. So that
dude,
was...
you're in a slasher movie. You never miss an opportunity to get laid because everyone's getting laid.
Yeah, well, this guy could have got laid, I think. We'll never know because the girl got an arrow in the eye.
She might have been a little bit iffy on his white afro going on.
Yeah, and yeah, he was
his receding hairline, white afro. She might have been a little turned off by that. Maybe
he was pretty annoying. He's actually, that guy quit acting. He's now a really big time entertainment lawyer.
Oh yeah, yeah,
looks
yeah.
like very successful. So, but it had the bikers in it, which they were pretty cool, and it had, and this is the one that had that really great ending. That this ending of Friday the 13th Part 3 always scared me, and it still does. And it doesn't scare me as much as it used to, but Jason makes this like groan sound that still kind of creeped me out. And Jason was Richard Brooker in this, who was mm-hmm. One of the more famous Jasons, even though he was only in the one. But I think it's probably because of the hockey mask.
Probably.
He was a stuntman, and he's kind of one of the beloved Jasons.
So I don't want to really spoil anything, but I am curious. Is that in the ending, the part that you're saying messed you up?
Yeah.
Now, is it the part involving the callback to part one, or is it the part before that involving Jason himself?
No, it's the part before that involving Jason himself.
Okay, so like, you know, I know what you're talking about now. Okay, I can understand.
He does this thing. He goes, like that.
Oh, yeah. That's so when he's like freaky. Ricking out the window.
Oh, freaked me out.
Okay.
It still bothers me.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, the kills in it were okay. I mean, you're starting to see the series maybe slipping a little bit. Still was pretty a pretty strong entry, but I can see it slipping a little bit.
And also, this was 3D, so it was obvious where the 3D was. Because there was scenes with, like, the guy trying to put up the clothesline, putting the clothesline pole right into the camera and everything like that.
And it did make me realize, like, why don't they do that anymore with 3D? Like,
They did in My Bloody Valentine 3D. They did the kind of stuff. They had Tom Atkins when he was the sheriff with his rifle, and he swiveled on the porch with the rifle, and it came butting out of the screen. And I thought that was really cool when I saw that in the theater.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think part four is... You're going to like part four. Part four is a step up from three for sure.
Yeah.
Final chapter is my second favorite of the entire series. And it's Joseph Zito, who did Missing in Action and Red Scorpion and The Prowler and stuff like that. So I think you're in for a treat.
No,
with
I'm looking
your next
forward
one.
To it. I got to say, I'm really enjoying the series much better than those other two.
Those other two.
But I'm going to watch Nightmare after these ones, I think. So
yeah, maybe.
But we'll see. The other one I wanted to mention is one we watched actually together after the last podcast called Lunch Wagon.
Oh, Lunch Wagon.
And this was a 1981 sex comedy.
I'm sensing a trend in what we watch after we record.
directed by Ernie Pintoff, who also was responsible for Jaguar Lives, which I haven't seen yet, but I do have the Arrow release of that, which looks pretty cool. This is starring one of my favorites of the Playboy era of the 70s and 80s, Pamela Jean Bryant. I don't know why. She was one, like, I really had a crush on this girl when I was a teenager, thanks to a certain issue of Playboy that I happen to have. And but she was pretty awesome.
She spends most of Lunch Wagon in a nice tight white t-shirt, if I recall correctly.
Those pants.
Yeah. That's how you get people to come to your catering wagon, is you get girls in tight t-shirts and little short like camel toe almost shorts, and you're gonna get construction guys there, no doubt.
Yeah. So we had Pamela Bryant and she was in Private Lessons and Hots as well as Playboy. Roseanne Caton, who was in Bachelor Party. She was one of the hookers in Bachelor Party, and she's also in a whole bunch of like exploitation movies. Ebony, Ivory, and Jade. She was in Sergio Santiago's The Mothers. Well, he did Ebony, Ivory, and Jade as well. She was also in The Swinging Cheerleaders. You also had a few Van Pattens in this
movie.
Lots
of Van Pattens.
We had Dick Van Patten in a small role. We had James Van Patten, and you might remember him from a movie called The Young Warriors in the 80s. And he was also in a bunch of the Saw movies as a coroner. And we also had Dale Bozzio and Terry Bozzio from the band Missing Persons.
Don't forget there was a Dick Van Patten. Did you say there was a Dick Van Patten?
Dick was in there at the beginning.
There's three of them.
The other one was playing keyboards for Missing Persons, even though he wasn't in Missing Persons. Yeah. And the band Missing Persons, so if you're not familiar with the band, they had a big hit in the 80s called Walking in L.A. The lead singer was Dale Bozzio, and the drummer was Terry Bozzio. And this band was in this movie under a different name. I can't remember what they were called.
Yeah, I don't recall.
But yeah, it was kind of weird, like, seeing them in there, and they kept playing the same song over and over, and they were acting and stuff. Terry Bozzio has, like, become a really famous drummer. He's, you know, he plays with Jeff Beck and Joe Satriani and all these, like, super famous musicians. And Terry, or Dale
plays
Bozzio
with a lot of guitar wankery is what he plays with.
And Dale Bozzio has gone, the singer has... She's gone on to a life of, well, I think she might be in jail, or she got charged for, like, neglecting cats or something. I think she was, like, collecting cats.
Crazy cat lady?
She was a super crazy cat lady.
She went from a new wave band to crazy cat
lady? Yeah, it's kind of sad, actually. I don't know why I know these
things. Almost like a downfall. It's almost a vanity level downfall, but not quite.
In a really, it's kind of sad. So I don't know what the story was, but I think she had all these cats in her house, and they started dying because of neglect, because she... I guess wasn't keeping care of them all, and some sort of animal control came in. I don't know. Wikipedia at peeps.
This is a pretty upsetting topic. We're
anyway. I guess we should go back to Lunch Wagon.
I don't want to talk about animals.
No, Lunch Wagon. Anyway, Lunch Wagon. It's kind of hard to find. It's a pretty good, you know, sex comedy from the era.
Yeah, with like the mobsters trying to get the diamonds with the competing Lunch Wagon, and all that kind of stuff. For what it was watchable.
Yeah, definitely notable for Pamela Jean Bryan. It's her major starring role for this girl who, you know, never really made it. But if you ever have had a thing for her or have seen her around, this is the one to watch.
Mm-hmm.
How about you, Chris?
Okay. Well, I just have about three things to talk about. I did have Lunch Wagon written down, too, so you already beat me to it. I watched a movie called... Strange Behavior, which is also known as Dead Kids, and it's a kind of a Australian production, but it's not Australian. It's set in small town USA, so nobody has accents in it or anything like that. It's kind of a weird amalgamation of a slasher movie and like a science fiction, in the sense that it's about these kids in town going and doing testing at the university, which kind of corrupts their brain and lets people control their brains to commit murders.
Right.
And there was actually some pretty good mood in the movie at the beginning, because it hit this small town vibe, and it was like kind of whimsical, like Leave It to Beaverish at the beginning. And there was a couple of pretty cool kind of death moments in it. There's this really effective scene where the maid or whatever she is comes into the house and finds one of the kids in the bathtub with his hand sawn off, and then she thinks she hears noises from the house and goes to investigate, and then hears noises coming from the bathroom again, and when she goes in there, there's a girl in there sawing off the other hand that chases her down.
Oh, yeah, I can't remember that.
So there's this like kind of cool vibe to it there, but then it kind of shits the bed in the last 40 minutes when it brings in the science vibe to the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very interesting kind of concept, because slasher movies at the time were so formulaic and template, and it kind of steps away from that while having these slasher undertones. So I appreciated that about the movie, but I didn't dig it as much as I was hoping.
It's one of those movies that's kind of beloved. Like, it's got a real cult following. It's just one of these ones that I just found not very memorable.
Yeah, I had a hard time getting into the second half of it. Yeah. But the director, Michael Loughlin, did make Strange Invaders a couple years later, which I've always been curious about, just because I remember on the back of the Vestron video VHS box, it had some guy with his head splitting open and like an alien coming out of it. So I've always been curious about that movie. It stars Karen Black, and it's kind of Invaders from Mars-ish in tone.
It had a cool cover too, didn't it?
Yeah. It's pretty neat looking, so I might want to check that out in the future.
Strange Behavior, I believe, was remade as Disturbing Behavior with Katie Holmes.
Was it really?
And that guy, James Marsden. I'm pretty sure that's
a loose, very similar plot points.
Yeah.
The other thing I watched was that I want to mention, and this isn't B movie or horror movie or anything like that, but I watched Whiplash.
Oh, you did?
Which is up for Best Picture at the Academy Awards next month.
And what's his name? Just got a Golden Globe.
Yeah, J.K. Simmons just won Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actor, and he just won the Screen Actors Guild one, too.
Okay. Yeah, I really want to see that.
It's the story of a kid in university or college, I don't know what one or the other, and he wants to be a drummer. That's his life ambition, is to be a drummer, and it's a arts college or whatever it is, and J.K. Simmons runs the band program there, and they're prestigious. So he somehow manages to work his way into this program because J.K. Simmons' character sees him practicing one night and just takes an interest in him. But what the guy doesn't realize is that J.K. Simmons character just expects perfection from everybody, and he'll get that perfection by berating them, treating them like shit, and just basically hammering at them and hammering at them and hammering at them. He reminded me so much of the drill sergeant in Full Metal Jacket while I'm watching it, because he's just like hammering, 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 just psychological terror, psychological terror, just like insulting everybody, being crude, rude, and obnoxious to them, just so he can get the results of winning these band competitions and everything.
Wow. But
the best thing about it is the Miles Teller character, which is the kid who is brought in. He also kind of is brought into this, and he's psychologically scarred, but there's a turnaround in the movie that was really cool by the end, and it's just such strong performances and just like overwhelming performances by the leads. J.K. Simmons, if he does not win that Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, I will be upset.
Who's he up against, you know?
I can't remember off the top of my head. I think it's like Ed Norton for Birdman and some other people like that, but he deserves it. He's so gripping in that movie, because I'm watching a movie, I'm like, this is a movie about a kid drumming, how gripping is this gonna be?
Yeah,
but you're just like glued to that screen the entire time. Wow. Because he's just, it's so intense. I never knew that drumming in a band, like a college university band, would be so intense.
Huh.
And even Miles Teller, who's the main actor, he's so good too, but he doesn't get the recognition because he's overshadowed by J.K. Simmons at all turns. But
right.
He's really awesome too, where he's driven towards impressing his teacher to the point where he's practicing so much he's getting these blisters in his webbing of his hands, and they're bursting while he's drumming and bleeding all over the drums, but he just band-aids it up and just works through the pain because he wants to impress this guy so much. But it's also because he's been so psychologically beaten down that that's why he wants to impress him so much.
Wow.
It's a very intense movie, from way more intense than I was expecting.
Huh.
So I definitely recommend that. That's probably, I'm going to say that's my second favorite movie of 2014.
Oh.
Number one's Grand Budapest Hotel.
Ugh.
But that's besides the point. It's because I'm a Wes Anderson quirky, nerdy type. Don't sigh.
When are you going to Portland again?
Huh?
When are you going to Portland again?
In February. Yes, hipster Portland. The only other thing I wanted to mention was Tobey Hooper, who directed Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Mm-hmm.
And Poltergeist, wrote a novel that I didn't know about.
What's it called?
Midnight Movie.
What's it about?
And he wrote it in 2011, and it's kind of a weird amalgamation where Tobey Hooper is himself in the book. And it's supposed to be like a retelling to an author about an event where they find his lost movie, which is called Destiny Road, I believe, and it's like a weird zombie movie in that. And when people watch it, someone discovers it, and when they watch it, they start like becoming violent. They start having like blue sexual discharges. They get really like
that's what's happening.
It causes this epidemic, this zombie epidemic through all of America because of the people who started this movie. And it's told from like blog posts and like news articles and that for the first half. And then Tobey Hooper has to team up with this movie critic kid to like stop this epidemic from happening by refilming the movie and everything. It's really bizarre. It's so offbeat. It reminded me a lot of the book John Dies at the End, and the sequel There's Spiders in This Book, because it's just such an offbeat tone and really bizarre. I really wasn't entertained by it. It's not the greatest book in the world, but it's worth mentioning because it's Tobey Hooper.
Nice.
And I had no idea he wrote a book. So
yeah, I wouldn't mind checking that out.
Check that one out. But that's it for me. So
great.
Why don't we head into our lycanthrope topic here.
Okay.
I'm being all fancy with a fancy word to start it off. So we were talking about subgenres and monsters, and we decided we would tackle werewolves first.
Yes.
Because they kind of have a bad rap for me. Like they just don't seem to get the recognition that other kind of monsters do. Like,
yeah.
Like zombies, way overplayed.
Yes.
Vampires is, I've always said that if you want to make an indie movie for cheap, make a vampire movie. And that's kind of overplayed to me too. I'm sick and tired of vampires for the most part.
Yeah.
Unless they're like Near Dark type vampires, and then I'm on board. But why don't we talk a little bit about werewolves and like a little bit about the legends of werewolves and things like that. And then we'll go from there. So as we all know, werewolves have to do with people transforming from man to beast.
Shapeshifters,
yes. Yeah. And it's usually when there's a full moon out.
Yeah.
Which, thankfully, there isn't tonight.
Although there's one coming up.
Josh is looking a little bit hairy from where I'm sitting, so I'm getting a little scared. And there's always the way to kill them is always like silver bullets and things like that. If you follow modern
fictional, it's interesting with a mythology. Lot of the lore with werewolves yeah. was created through movies.
Yeah.
Which is different than some of the other well, monsters.
Did you research at all the like actual mythology of how the werewolf came to be and like how it got into lore and stuff to begin with?
I didn't really. I mean, we'll talk a little bit in a minute about how the werewolf movies got started, but it's a little different than vampires because there was no Dracula that mm-hmm. Bram Stoker wrote or Mary Shelley's Frankenstein to sort of get things going.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of legends about werewolves and shapeshifters, but I think a lot of the pop culture-y type ideas we get about werewolves were created in film.
Yeah, and I've always kind of find werewolves more fascinating than, say, vampires and things like that, because vampires and werewolves, they're both tortured.
Yes.
They're always portrayed as being tortured, whereas I find that the reason that werewolves, to me, are more interesting is because you have that shape-shifting element. You have these people who are going through this transformation of their bodies, which they most of the time have no desire to have. Like they're usually accidentally thrown into this curse.
Yes.
And
they call it a curse. Vampires, yeah. They don't necessarily call it a curse.
Yeah.
And the werewolf has to also be beware of the moon, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they know when that moon turns full that they're going to be going through a shitty night.
And I mean, and if you can imagine, like, how scary is that to be where you're looking and you're watching the moon and you're trying to plan how you're going to stop yourself? You can't stop yourself from transforming. And when you transform, how much of that are you really going to remember? And if you go by movie lore, you're not.
No.
Like, and how scary is that? Like, I've passed out drunk before, blacked out before, and not remembered things. But I'd imagine waking up in the morning and seeing that three people were murdered in the night is a lot more hardcore than finding out that you told some girl that she was a bitch in the middle of the night, right? Like, and just the body, like, how would the body not break down from you shifting forms all the time? Like,
well, that's the thing I don't understand.
I think that would
werewolves.
Be like an interesting topic. Like, I don't know if any
like
movies
how do you go
have,
back?
Yeah, like yeah. I don't know if any movies have tackled the actual strain and stress on a human body, on how it would affect the infrastructure of a body from transforming, like shape shifting so much. Like, if your bones become brittle or were to explode from them being stretched out so much and things like that. And that's always been something that's kind of caught my attention where I'm always curious about, because
you better trademark that idea, buddy.
Yeah. It's just a scary thought
yeah.
of not having control of your body and then your body actually changing.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, we change with puberty, but not like this.
Yeah. It's crazy. And the changes are so intense. I mean, and again, we're going by movies, right? Mm-hmm. We're going by what we've seen in movies
yeah.
as to how the changing would be. Maybe if there's a real werewolf, it's not that bad.
Well, yeah, maybe it's kind of like some of those old school werewolf movies you saw where it just seems to be a bunch of fur all suddenly appeared on their
exactly.
cheeks and stuff. But let's talk about some old werewolf movies to kick off here. I'm going to mostly give you the mic on this because I'm not that comfortable talking about the Universal era that much because you have a little bit more experience with them than me, I think.
Sure.
But why don't we talk about what is kind of acknowledged as the first werewolf movie, which we both admittedly have not seen, called Werewolf of London.
Yep, it was filmed in 1935, and it's a Universal movie. So this is a Universal werewolf movie, and it really is. It's kind of touted as the first werewolf
but it's,
movie.
But it's not considered part of the canon, is it? Like,
no, it's like one of the first Universal horror movies, and it's one of the first. It is one of the first werewolf movies. There was a silent movie made before it. It was a short, also by Universal, that's also a werewolf movie. I don't know the name of it off the top of my head, but it's kind of the first Universal monster movie and the first werewolf
now,
movie.
Now, do we know if is this included in any of those sets that you can get?
I'm not sure. Now, Werewolf of London is.
Okay.
So that's it's kind of the sort of starting
so
point
like
for
I
werewolves.
Have at home, and I don't remember what's in the set, so forgive me for this. I have that Universal set at home that came with the three statuettes, and it has the Dracula, Frankenstein, Wolfman, and all that in it.
Yep.
Is that movie going to be included in that werewolf set? Do we know?
There's been a recent Universal Monster set with like 35 movies in it.
That has Werewolf of London.
It's definitely in that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I should check because I really should check that movie out.
Yeah, I want to check it out too. Now, the makeup artist on it was Jack Pierce, and Jack Pierce was kind of like the go-to guy for Universal at the time. And he's the guy who created all the famous monsters. Yeah. He created the Mummy, Frankenstein, and the werewolf we know, which we'll talk about in a second.
And his design set the template for everything to follow.
Exactly. Now, Jack Pierce, unfortunately, in Werewolf of London, wasn't able to do what he really wanted to do because the lead actor, Henry Hull, didn't want to deal with the makeup. So Pussy. You'll notice that the makeup effects in Werewolf of London aren't like they were in The Wolfman because of Henry Hull's reluctance to have like the full-on, you know, Lon Chaney full.
So he had the
full bore.
He just had the fur glued to
his
face.
He just had some fur on his face. Ugh. It still looked pretty cool, but it wasn't what we kind of know as a werewolf. Mm-hmm. Werewolf of London was followed by a sequel in 1946 called She-Wolf of London, starring June Lockhart from Lost in Space. But the sequel was more of almost like a mystery. I actually can't even remember if there was actually a werewolf in it or not. It's kind of like a is she, isn't she thing.
Oh, okay.
And I can't remember if it was like actually a werewolf or if it was one of those dupe jobs where it's like everyone thinks it's a werewolf, like Hound of the Baskervilles or something like that. So, but those were kind of...
What was that you just did?
Hound of the Baskervilles. Hound of the Baskervilles. I didn't want to spoil it. So that was kind of the first werewolf movie. But the one we all know is the one that came out in 1941 called The Wolfman.
Mm-hmm.
And this was directed by George Wagner and stars Lon Chaney Jr. as Lawrence Talbot.
Yep.
And he's this dude and he's cursed by this gypsy.
Those goddamn gypsies.
And I can't remember. It's Maria.
What the fuck is up with gypsies?
Or
why
something.
Are gypsies such assholes?
I know. So she curses him with the...
Sorry,
the
gypsies.
The curse. Oh, no. We're going to get on gypsies now. At least it's not clerics.
Yeah.
So she curses Lon Chaney Jr. with the curse, and he turns into the Wolfman. And this is the guy... We remember it from the Universal canon.
And this is the
full-on
guy...
hair face.
Yes. And this is the guy who pretty much set... The tropes for every single werewolf movie after.
Lon Chaney Jr. owned werewolves, yep. I'd say from the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Yep.
So he played him in The Wolfman. This is the classic. It's still a classic. It's still a great movie. And when you talk about tortured, I thought Lon Chaney Jr. nailed it because he was scared. He didn't want this. He was terrified by the moon. He knew he was going to turn into a wolf. He knew he was going to kill. And he really got that out there. I mean, I remember the first time I saw Lon Chaney Jr. playing the werewolf was in Abbott and Costello Meets Frankenstein.
I think that's most people's
most
first.
Of our generation, yeah. Anyway. And, of course, that's another, you know, classic. But that I just remember him from that. And I remember, God, this guy's so whiny. All he's doing is whining about not wanting to turn into a werewolf. Why can't he be cool like Dracula and Frankenstein? But you know, now I really get it. Like, he was really getting across the curse of the werewolf. So after The Wolfman, Universal decided to do their first team up in 1943 with Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. And this was an okay movie. Chaney was back as the Wolfman again. The interesting thing about this one is that you had Bela Lugosi, who played Dracula, playing Frankenstein in this one, which is kind of weird to see Bela as Frankenstein.
The children of the night. What music they make.
Exactly. I mean, you're used to seeing Karloff as Frankenstein, so it was interesting that way. Universal carried it on with House of Dracula and House of Frankenstein. I don't know if you know those ones.
I'm not as familiar with Universal as I really should be.
So those ones came in the 1944, 1945, and those were kind of like Battle Royale of monsters. So they had a whole bunch of monsters in them. So it had Frankenstein, it had Dracula. I think John Carradine played Dracula.
There was elbow drops.
Yeah.
There was suplex. No,
but it was like all the monsters were showing up, right? Like they were all in it. It was like a mad monster party.
Yeah.
But, you know, Glenn Strange was playing Frankenstein, and then Lon Chaney was back as the Wolfman. And those were both quite popular movies for Universal. And then that was kind of the end of the run for Chaney with the Universal movies, and kind of the end of the run for the werewolf in the Universal movies. They carried on like The Mummy and Frankenstein, quite a few sequels, but that was kind of it for the Wolfman.
Yeah.
Chaney reprised the Wolfman one more time in the 60s in a movie called, I think it was called Face of the Screaming Werewolf. But that was kind of it for Chaney. But that one run of him playing Lawrence Talbot in all of these movies was kind of the quintessential Wolfman
That's usually the image that you see when you see Wolfman when it comes to films, is that Lawrence Talbot, Lon Chaney image. I mean, you can have as many cool werewolf transformations nowadays as you want, but everyone's always going to think of the classic for that.
Yeah, and he was like, it was different than some of the other werewolves we know because he was walking around like a man.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't a wolf, because in a lot of werewolf movies we see if they actually turn into wolves, where they're walking around like wolves on all fours. But the Lon Chaney werewolf grew fur, but he was still running around like a man.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the main points from the Universal era.
Well, was it the Universal ones that started the whole... I guess they would be the ones who started the full moon thing. And did they start the silver bullet?
They started the silver bullet. I believe that the silver bullet was introduced in the Wolfman.
Okay.
And I believe that the full moon thing was introduced in the Henry Hall one, the Werewolf of London.
Oh, okay.
And Werewolf of London is obviously where the movie we know more. So an American Werewolf of London got its inspiration as well.
See, here's me admitting to everybody that I'm really not astute on the Universal classics, and after tonight I may have to start diving into that box set that I have, because it looks awfully pretty sitting on my shelf, but maybe I should start watching the movies within.
Well, they're really, you know, I mean, the Universal movies, I think a lot of people nowadays find them kind of boring, but I mean, those classics, like those top six with, you know, the Wolfman, Dracula, like the first one of all those, the first Frankenstein, the first Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Oh, yeah, I love that
they're
one.
They're all so good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they still are. Even the Mummy. Like, the Mummy's the one that I find a little bit, maybe, just a little bit boring.
I find Dracula a little bit,
Yeah. I love Dracula, and God, Dracula's brides were so hot in that movie. But anyway, if you check out nothing else of the Universal, check out the original Wolfman, because it's really good. Yeah. So I guess after the Universal movies, I guess we get into the like.
Well, there was the shit era, really, of werewolves. If we think about it, like the '60s and seventies, where we had movies like Werewolves on Wheels that we were talking about earlier. And
but I mean, is it shit? I mean, that's pretty, well, I mean, it's probably not a very good movie, but
it's shit in the sense of, if you're going for this serious tortured tone of the Wolfman, they're shit.
Yeah.
For drive-in entertainment, you know, Werewolf of Washington, you know.
Well, I mean, I think we should talk about Werewolves on Wheels for a sec, because it's a bloody biker movie where these bikers like bust in on this like satanic ritual and get cursed, and are bike, like motorbike riding werewolf gang. Like,
you see that shit everywhere.
How awesome is that? Like, just for points for originality. I mean, you can't knock it.
Like, if you love biker movies, and you like werewolf movies, then it's like putting your chocolate in your peanut butter kind of deal right there, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
But you remember, this isn't really werewolf related, but do you remember in the around the same year there was that British movie Psychorama, which was like
Psychomania,
which
it's
was
an awesome
wasn't
movie.
That like a biker movie mixed with zombies?
Yeah, it's an awesome movie.
Yeah, I've never seen it.
It's really cool.
I just thought I would bring that up.
Psychomania, that's what it's called.
Okay, yeah. I just thought I'd bring it up because, you know, it's kind of similar.
Yeah, I got that on like one of those like $1.99 like EP VHSs and fell in love with that movie.
Okay, I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Anyway, back to werewolves.
So, yeah, I mean, the 60s, 50s and 60s, there wasn't a lot of werewolf activity. I mean, the two I can sort of think of, Hammer got in on it with Curse of the Werewolf.
Yeah, even Hammer didn't really play those out as much
as
they did Dracula and Frankenstein,
because
Oliver Reed, right?
Oliver Reed. And again, like, not Oliver Reed hated playing the role.
I actually thought the makeup effects in that one was kind of cool, though.
Yeah.
Because it was like a kind of a tanny skin color and everything, and it was like the fur was more ringing the face than actually on the face, and I thought that was kind of an interesting, because the image I always remember from Curse of the Werewolf is Oliver Reed in the makeup with his two fangs protruding with the little rivulets of blood going down his chin.
Yeah.
Like, that's the famous image from that. I've only seen it once when I was a kid, so I honestly don't remember anything about it. But it's probably, if it's Hammer, it's probably all gothy and
it's not, you know. Yeah, like when I think of Hammer, I don't think of Curse of the Werewolf.
I don't think many people do.
Yeah. And then, you know, also Amicus got in on it as well with The Beast Must Die.
Yeah, which I didn't like.
No, I haven't seen it.
Beast Must Die was like 10 little Indians mixed with like a, you know, because it was like bringing all these people to this retreat and being like, who's the werewolf through the whole movie. And then I recall they even had a moment in it where they took a break where it's like
the werewolf break.
Is it this person? Yeah. And they, you know, Amicus, like they always did, would ride on Hammer's coattails.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they friggin' cast Peter Cushing in the lead role and all that. Yeah. I said coattails. I was going to say they were riding their dick, but I thought it'd be a little bit less crude. But, you know, I didn't like Beast Must Die.
Yeah. I've only seen the trailer and, I thought the trailer was kind of cool, and it's exactly like you said. It's like 10 little Indians, and one of them's a werewolf, and then there's this break where you can decide which one of them's a werewolf and see if you're right.
Interestingly enough, there's a similar theme in another movie we're going to mention later with that 10 little Indians thing.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so we'll get to that.
Anyway, I like it because it's got that sort of William Castle vibe, but I don't know. I don't know if the movie's good. And Peter Cushing, you know, he's usually good, but it didn't look like... I was thinking of it like he was like the star. Like the way I always thought this movie, I thought he was like a werewolf hunter, but it doesn't look like that's the case.
Well, they always make it look like that because he shows him on the poster with a shotgun.
Because he's fucking Van Helsing, right?
Guy can kill Dracula, but he can't kill a werewolf. God damn.
So, anyway, that was kind of it. And then we get into the 70s and things started getting weird, like Chris mentioned. But I found things didn't really start getting going again for the old Wolfman until we got to the 80s.
We all know what the werewolf year was. The salad days for werewolves, since I said were, was 1981.
Absolutely.
Which is where, for some reason, the werewolves came raging back onto the screen in three separate movies. And two of them to this day are considered essential.
Yeah.
And one of them is sadly not. So let's talk about those.
Sure.
So let's kick off with the one that was released first, which was The Howling.
Right.
Now, we both recently watched this movie in preparation for this. And it's funny how we both came away with it where we're kind of like, I don't know if I liked that as much as I did when I was a kid. There's just, like, I found something about the vibe of it was off for me as an adult. And I had such high expectations going and seeing this again because it was Joe Dante.
Yep.
Who had made Piranha for Corman.
Yep.
And went on to make Gremlins.
Yep.
And Gremlins is my favorite little monster movie ever made.
And John Dante is a huge genre fan as well. And I can't leave that out.
And John Sayles wrote it.
Yep.
And everyone knows John Sayles is like, well, anyone who knows movies knows John Sayles is famous for his writing.
Yeah.
Didn't he also write Piranha?
Yes.
Yeah. So.
Or actually, he might have written Piranha 2, The Spawn.
And he wrote Alligator.
Yes.
Yeah. So he had experience in the monster movies.
Yeah.
He went on to more serious political thrillers and dramas and stuff in the future. But it starts off really good for me. It had this sleazy 42nd Street vibe, but it was set in Los Angeles. And D. Wallace was a news reporter who was being stalked by this like serial killer guy. And he was like menacing her on the phone and everything. And the cops set her up on this sting to meet up with him.
Yeah.
And she went to meet him in this peep show.
Yeah, I know.
And something happens, which, you know, they don't know about it, but we know that he kind of does this weird transformation.
That was a weird scene,
because they're showing this chick basically being raped on the movie, and he's standing behind her transforming, and you're just like, what the fuck is going on right now?
Yeah.
So she gets traumatized, obviously, by this, and she can't do her job. And we had cameos already because Joe Dante likes peppering cameos. So we had Kevin McCarthy from Invasion of the Body Snatchers playing the head of the
TV station.
Later in the movie, we have Dick Miller showing up from Bucket of Blood. And there's a bunch of other people.
Roger Corman was in that.
Roger Corman has a scene near the beginning where she gets off the phone with the serial killer guy. And he's the guy who was waiting for the phone.
Yeah.
So he just has that brief 2-second cameo. But, I mean, from there, she goes to a psychologist, played by Patrick McNee.
Right, from the Avengers.
From the Avengers TV show.
Yes.
And the 60s TV show. And he sends her to this kind of this retreat called The Colony.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, for me, it was kind of like this hippie retreat, like hippie slash
new agey,
deliverance, new agey kind of.
If it was now,
vibe.
People would be doing fucking yoga there.
Yeah, instead they're fucking hunting shit.
I wonder, werewolves would probably be able to do pretty wicked yoga, though.
Probably. <They're> pretty flexible. But she goes there with her husband, who's played by Chris Stone.
Her real life husband.
Well, he wasn't at the time.
Oh.
The thing, they got married after this movie, which I thought was hilarious because Dee Wallace and Christopher Stone play a husband and wife in the movie, but they are, he cheats on her.
Yeah.
Like he's you know, he cheats on her with one of the werewolf babes.
Elizabeth Brooks, yes.
Yeah. And so that's funny that they got married. It's just kind of an ironic kind of piece of trivia. And she goes there and things start happening, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, people are acting weird to begin with, but then there's like, you know, howls in the night and just all this stuff. And we find out that it's a tribe of werewolves. And we find out that maybe that serial killer who everyone thought might have been dead might not be dead. And it just escalates from there. And at the same time, we have those two people who are kind of investigating werewolves and all that, who have come to a revelation later in the movie. But the thing about it was I wasn't buying it. As much as I thought I would. I couldn't get into the characters as much as I wanted to. Like, I was drooling over, what's
Dee
her
Wallace?
Name? Elizabeth Brooks? Is that
oh, yeah,
name?
Elizabeth Brooks, yeah.
Because she's going through the whole movie in this tight leather with her cleavage hanging out and everything.
Yeah,
and
she looks good.
You know, there's that sex scene in front of the fire where they transform into werewolves in the middle of it and everything. Yeah. It's really freaking cool.
She was heavily, heavily religious, I found out. And she, I don't think she knew she was going to be, I don't think she knew the nudity was going to be shown, but what a scene. I think for a lot of young guys, that was one of those
scenes. That's a pretty cool scene. And the Rob Bottin's...
Botine,
sorry. Yeah. His effects are pretty cool. Like
It was kind of like the 80s was, it felt to me like the werewolves were kind of like where all the effects guys were like, look what I can do.
Yeah. Slapping their dicks on the table.
Yeah. I mean, I thought Rob Bottin's, to me, his crowning achievement's always going to be a thing.
Yeah.
But he did a pretty good job.
Well, wasn't this like one of his first gigs, The Howling?
Well, because
he was working for Rick Baker, wasn't he?
The story goes that Bottin was Rick Baker's prodigy, right? Yep. Like, he was learning everything from Rick Baker. The story goes that Rick Baker had... Okay, so John Landis had asked Rick Baker to do American Werewolf in London, and he was fucking taking forever to get this shit done. So The Howling came along, and they were like, hey, Rick Baker, we want you to do The Howling. And Rick Baker's like, okay, I'm done waiting for you, Landis. I'm doing The Howling. And then Landis apparently phoned Rick Baker and was like, okay, I've got it ready. Let's do this. Talking about American Werewolf in London, and got really pissed off at Rick Baker. So I guess what happened is Rick Baker then decided to go back to Landis, and that's how Bottin got the job.
Hmm.
So, and Rick Baker was a consultant on The Howling.
I mean, I thought the werewolf effects were pretty decent in it.
They were pretty good. I mean,
apart from a scene in the end, which I'm not going to ruin for people that I didn't like the effects of.
Yeah.
You'll see. It's in the last like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I didn't really dig it as much as I remembered.
You know, I thought I'd seen The Howling when I was a teenager, and watching it now. And I remember not really liking it. I remember being like, ah, The Howling, I don't really get it. So I watched it again. And I don't even know if I saw it when I was young. Like, it was that not memorable to me. Watched it again. Wasn't really enjoying it while I was watching it. Thinking about it now, like a week later, I think it was okay.
Yeah, it was.
I can kind of see why people were into it.
It's watchable, but I don't understand how it managed to have 7 sequels.
Oh, God.
Which, yeah. We're going to briefly, I'll briefly talk about the sequels. They're all.
Just one more thing about The Howling. Yep. Just, if you're interested in watching The Howling, do not watch the trailer. Because the trailer for The Howling has, like, a humongoid spoiler in it.
Yeah.
And I just strongly urge you to not watch it. It is a classic werewolf movie. If you're interested in the genre, it's kind of required viewing.
Yeah, you should watch it.
But don't watch the trailer. Just don't watch the trailer until after you see the movie.
No matter what we say, watch The Howling.
Yeah.
It's kind of prerequisite.
Yeah. So go on.
The sequels, though, have nothing to do with nothing. They have no relation to any of the other movies. Howling 2 is awesome because awesomely bad. But it has Sybil Danning.
Yeah.
And it has Christopher Lee.
Yes.
And it makes no sense, but if you want to see Sybil Danning covered with fur ripping her top off repeatedly in the end credits, that's the movie to watch.
That's all I remember is Sybil Danning naked wearing... Yeah.
I remember nothing about Howling 2, but I'm still kind of might pick it up when it comes out on Blu-ray later this year from Scream Factory.
And it also had Reb Brown in it.
Yeah, well.
But, the only thing I've got, I don't remember this. I think I'm going to pick up that Scream Factory because I do remember the...
It's camp.
The nudity and the fur. But, anyway, we'll leave that alone.
And then the third one went to Australia, where the werewolves had like little pouches in their bellies, like kangaroos.
Really?
Yeah. The fourth one called itself The Original Nightmare, which was supposed to go back to the sequel that the novelist Gary Bradner wrote to his original book, The Howling.
Right.
And it's about a writer going out to the woods, kind of a retreaty kind of place again, and becoming attacked by werewolves. And then we have part 5, which is the 10 Little Indians callback I have, because it's very similar.
They go to
like a dinner party, I believe. I haven't seen these in a while, so if I'm wrong, call me out on it. But they go to a dinner party and there's a werewolf amongst them and they have to figure out who it is.
Okay.
And then we have the other sequels, which I don't want to talk about. I just remember that the 2010 one, which was The Howling Reborn, seemed like it was a teenage movie, like Twilight mixed with like Howling, just with the name on it. So it's kind of weird. I should have mentioned this on our last episode about sequels, about how the fuck did they make 8 Howling movies?
Yeah. There was 8 in total. There was a bit of a stretch between part 7, The New Moon Rising.
Yeah.
And then the next one came out in 2011, which was 15 years later. Yeah. So, I don't know. There's not much to say about the sequels. The first part two and three were directed by Philippe Mora, who did The Beast Within, which is another shapeshifter movie, which I haven't seen. But
written by Tom Holland.
It's got a lot of
Fright Night.
Yeah, it's supposed to be pretty good. And then part 4 was directed by John Huff, yeah, who did Watcher in the Woods and the Witch Mountain movies and also The Legend of Hell House. So I'm thinking that one can't be that bad, right?
I don't remember liking any of the sequels.
Wow. Because the other ones, I don't know anything about the director, anyone that's
actually
in them,
I think
nothing.
Part 6 was okay because it was set at like a freak show circus thing.
Yeah, it's called The Freaks.
And it had a vampire in it too.
Oh, okay.
So it was kind of like a vampire versus werewolf vibe, if I remember correctly.
So is it worth putting yourself through the Howling series or no?
Dude, when I was a kid and we could get 5 VHS movies for 5 days for $5, I'd get everything.
Yeah.
Sequels for sure, just because I was a glutton for punishment.
So would you recommend these to a listener or no?
I'd say watch the second one.
Yeah.
And that's it. I think you're good if you watch the first two.
So do what Scream Factory is putting out and stop there.
Pretty much.
Okay. Because I don't think they'll put out the other ones.
So since we mentioned American Werewolf, let's talk about American Werewolf.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the werewolf movie as far as I'm concerned.
The werewolf movie.
Yeah.
It's John Landis was coming off of making Animal House and Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
And I think it's this movie that got him the gig directing Thriller for Michael Jackson.
Yeah, might have been. Video. But also had a werewolf in it.
Yeah, because Michael Jackson turns into a werewolf.
Yeah.
But this is cool because it's David Naughton and his best friend. Who plays him again? I'm sorry.
Griffin Dunn.
And they go to London. They end up in the backwoods, kind of. They end up at
the moors.
The moors. And they end up at the
Slaughtered Lamb
pub. And they're told, don't go out there in the fog and the dark. And
beware the moors, yeah.
Yeah, and being Americans and being, you know, kind of like, yeah, we do what we want. We're American.
Yeah.
They do, and they get attacked by a werewolf.
Yeah.
And it's here that, his friend dies.
Yeah.
And he kind of starts transforming. And this is an interesting one because I think it's one of the first ones where it was played for an intentional comedy. Like, you know, Werewolves on Wheels and all them, they were they were campy as shit, but I don't think they were played for comedy. I think John Landis intentionally put these comedic scenes in this movie. Like, yeah. He had the, you know, him running around naked in the zoo and stealing the balloons off that little British kid.
That American man stole my balloons.
Yeah, there was comedy in it on purpose. Like, every time he kept seeing his best friend kept showing up in visions.
Yeah.
Like, warning him, like, you got to kill yourself. You know, you got to do this. It would be more funny, like having him have a Mickey Mouse doll and going, hey, David, like waving at him and stuff like that. It's just like so weird. And then that that scene that you said still messes you up where those Nazi werewolves kind of bust into his family home so that's and gun him down.
When he's got the curse, but he hasn't turned yet.
Yeah.
He's having all these fucked up dreams.
Yeah.
And one of them involves him thinking of his family and they're all in the house watching the Muppet Show. And these like Nazi
werewolves.
Monsters. Yeah. Like, burst in with
Uzis.
Oh, fuck, yeah.
So, I mean, it's a... But this is really where modern-day werewolf transformations and look came into play. Rick Baker pretty much reinvented the werewolf visage for movies with this movie. I believe it was the first movie nominated for Best Special Effects Oscar.
I don't know.
I'm pretty sure it was.
Might have been, yeah.
John Landis peppered in a whole bunch of songs that were moon based, like Blue Moon and Bad Moon Rising.
Every song has the word moon in it.
And it's pretty cool that way. Like, it was an intentional thing. And there's the See You Next Tuesday reference, which I talked about in past episodes. But I just think it's a solid movie in the sense that David Naughton does show his confusion that I talked about when you're tortured. There was no real curse involved in this that I remember, but it's just...
It's just called the curse when you're bitten. Like, it's a curse because of the moon and you're
going to
kill.
He's just confused through the whole movie and he's being harassed by his friend, his dead friend, to kill himself. And he has this love affair with the nurse, which I kind of found a little bit glossed over and not that realistic.
The love part, I thought that was a little much. The wanting to have sex part, I totally get it.
Well, we've talked about American Werewolf in quite a bit of detail in a past episode, so I don't want to really delve into it too much this time.
Just if you're going to watch a werewolf movie and you haven't seen American Werewolf in London, go see it.
Just avoid that 1997 sequel.
An American Werewolf in Paris,
you mean? Yeah. Which is sad because the guy who directed it, Anthony Waller, he made Mute Witness...
Love Mute Witness.
Which, about 2-3 years before, he made American Werewolf in Paris.
Was.
And it's a great movie.
It's a great movie.
So I don't know what happened with that stumble. And I don't know why they felt it necessary to make one to begin with.
That's all I wrote down in my notes for this. I wrote down Anthony Waller, Tom Everett Scott, Julie Delpy, unnecessary.
Yeah, well, there. See, that's all you need to know about that one.
And totally shit CGI graphics. And this is actually... I found werewolf movies kind of took a turn after this one. And maybe I've got the years wrong, but just that's in my brain. This is where CGI came in and started fucking up werewolves. Now you have werewolf, you can either go practical or you can go CGI. And unfortunately, a lot of werewolf movies have gone the CGI route.
Well, I think Jurassic Park from 1993 was the movie that's kicked off the CGI.
I'm talking about werewolf movies in particular.
Like, I know, but I'm just trying to think if there's anything before that one. Probably you're right. I don't recall any werewolves before that. Because even Bad Moon, which came out the year before that, used practical. Apart from one scene.
Right.
One
and it
terrible
was the worst scene.
Scene
in that movie.
But
might as well talk about Bad Moon.
Well, we're going to go back to... We have to finish off with the 81. Because there's one more movie on there.
Oh, yes, of course.
Which I watched last night. I'd never seen it before, but it's lumped into this trio of movies, and it's called Wolfen.
Right.
And it's based on a Whitley Strieber novel.
Yep.
He also wrote The Hunger, which was made into a movie by Tony Scott in 1983 with David Bowie and Catherine Deneuve.
Susan
Sarandon, which is a vampire movie.
Yeah.
And he also wrote Communion, which is kind of famous for being the movie where he says it's nonfiction and that he got abducted by aliens and stuff like that. This one's really interesting to me because it's about a wealthy land developer who's trying to redo the Bronx in New York, like tear down all the slums and make this new kind of condos and stuff on the waterfront. And he goes to this area one night with his wife and their bodyguard to look at the area and, you know, visit this windmill that his ancestors had erected there when they first came to New York.
You said erected.
Erected. What is this, Beavis and Butthead? But they go there and they get attacked by a creature. And it's cool the way they stage this, because it does that kind of Predator vibe where it's point of view and it's reverse. So it's like bright neon colors, like heat sensors and stuff like that. And it's steady cam where it's running across the ground and ducking behind things so that the people don't see them and everything like that. And right off the bat, this catches me. This is in the first 10 minutes.
Is that cool or is it annoying?
It's really cool.
Okay.
I haven't seen this forever. I actually found it really cool. And I thought it was a good idea because going in, it's a werewolf movie in the sense that it's called Wolfen.
But is it a werewolf movie?
This is what I'm getting to here. So after they get brutally murdered, they bring in a kind of like an off-the-cuff detective played by Albert Finney called Dewey. And he's brought in to try to investigate these murders, but he's paired up with this criminal psychologist girl played by Diane Vernova.
Vernova.
And there's also this weird side vibe with this executive security council that looks after people trying to say it's terrorists. But Dewey thinks it's something else, so he starts investigating these murders. He's looking into the slums and everything, and other people are, like, homeless people and stuff are getting killed. And the one thing tying everything together is they find hair of wolves on the bodies. And this is where I'm like kind of sketchy on it. Brings in this Native American mysticism.
Right.
Which kind of like ties wolves and Native Americans and shape-shifting. And, you know, Edward James Olmos plays one of the rebellious Native Americans who kind of gives Dewey a hard time. And there's this really bizarre scene in it where he's like, he catches him running onto the beach and tearing all his clothes off and getting down on all fours and acting very feral and licking at this puddle on the beach and just romping around like he's a wolf and everything. And just like, it's a really weird scene.
Yeah. I heard about that scene.
And there's a lot of like mysticism brought to it. And this makes me wonder, like, I almost feel like it's not a werewolf movie, but it is a werewolf movie because there's never an actual werewolf,
right?
Traditional werewolf in it. There's no transformation scenes. The actual wolves in it are wolves. There's a shape-shifting element to the movie.
Yeah.
But this is a smart movie. It was way smarter than I was expecting going in.
Yeah.
And it's such a different take on the subgenre than the other two movies that came out the same year, like An American Werewolf and The Howling. And this is why I think maybe the movie got kind of pushed to the side, because it didn't have the fantastical effects. It didn't have like that kind of like grindhousey feel to it, because it was a mature movie.
Yeah.
Where it played out like a crime thriller for a
definitely
good
like a crime
portion
thriller,
of the movie. But it had this weird mystical angle to it that you don't see in a lot of these type of movies. And I'm really hesitant to call it an outright werewolf movie. And it's just, I really, really dug it.
Well, I'm glad we clarified, because I just know there's someone out there that's probably listening to this podcast wondering if we're going to mention Wolfen and then come and say, that's not a werewolf movie.
So, I'm very torn on it. In some ways it is, but in other ways it's not.
It's not a traditional one.
No, it's not traditional, but I really did enjoy it. I thought it was a really smart movie, and it was directed by Michael Wadley, who his only other directing credit is the Woodstock documentary. Yeah. And judging from the strength of this movie, this guy should have made more movies.
Yeah, it's surprising. I couldn't believe that that was the only other thing he'd done.
It's very well shot. It has some good suspense in it. And it's just really way more thought-provoking than I was expecting a movie that I went into thinking it was just going to be a werewolf rampaging through New York.
Yeah.
So I definitely would say check that one out.
I want to check it out again. Doesn't Gregory Hines have a really distracting earring in that movie too?
He has a distracting dangly earring in it, an afro, and he's the comic relief coroner kind of guy. But he was actually kind of fun.
He's always been pretty good, actually, even in his shitty movies.
So why don't we talk about Bad Moon then, since we mentioned it?
Yeah, let's talk about Bad Moon, because it is a... I really loved it. I hadn't seen it before, and just in researching this, I decided to give it a go.
Yeah.
So this came out in 1996, directed by Eric Red,
yep.
who wrote Near Dark.
Awesome.
And what
else?
The Hitcher, yeah.
And he also wrote and directed Body Parts.
Right.
With Jeff Fahey, which I really like.
Yeah. So Eric Red's kind of a cool dude. And this stars Michael Paré from from Eddie and the Cruisers and Streets of Fire, kind of a teen heartthrob, but kind of nearing the end of that at this point.
Yep.
And Marielle Hemingway, who was in Star 80 and also kind of not in the prime of her career. But wow, I really dug this movie. The opening scene has Michael in this like camp in Africa or something, and basically he's having sex and his girlfriend is riding him and then just gets torn apart literally by this giant wolf, and then Pari gets like scratched.
That scene,
it was awesome.
Holy shit. That's all I got to say.
I was like, oh my God.
Because
like,
I had watched this recently too. Yeah. We both kind of watched it like a day apart from each other. We didn't plan it that way. It just happened out that way. But that opening scene, I was always like, if they could keep that momentum going for this entire movie, this would be the best fucking werewolf movie ever made.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unfortunately, they didn't for me, but it was still pretty solid.
It was pretty good. So what happens is he goes back to America, and his sister is played by Marielle Hemingway, and she's a single mom with a young boy and a dog named Thor.
Oh, a boy and his dog.
And he goes to stay with them for a while because he's having some trouble, mainly the trouble being that he's
a motherfucking werewolf.
Yeah, he's tearing like, oh, it's like a forest surveyor rips him apart. And anyway, so he goes to stay in his Aerostream in his sister's backyard.
Yeah, and this is where a lot of the torture stuff that I talked about earlier comes in, because he like sneaks off and chains himself to trees.
Which
when
is,
he
yeah,
knows
the first time I've seen that.
When he says he knows there's a full moon coming, he purposely disconnects himself from his family and goes out into the middle of nowhere and chains himself to trees so that he knows that when he transforms, he's not going to hurt anybody.
Yeah. Which is, it was interesting because he does that, but at the same time, he seems kind of sinister as well.
Well, yeah.
So I don't really know what was up with that, but
I felt with the movie was only 80 minutes, and I felt like if it could have had another 20 minutes added to it for more development, it would have been really, really good.
Yeah. But the star of this movie I found was the werewolf itself. I mean, I thought it looked really good.
It looked pretty cool.
And it was a fight, you know, like it was kind of this like cat and mouse game between the, well, not even like, not really a cat and mouse, but like
it was more of
like a chess game almost between the werewolf, Michael Parry's werewolf
and the
guy
dog.
And the dog.
Well, because the dog knew
the
he
dog
was a werewolf.
Totally knew.
And he's like, oh, you're not going to mess with my family.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, that thing in it. And that kind of comes to a head near the end. And
it's really interesting because he's like, Michael Parry's like, yeah, it's like the dog's his nemesis, and they're kind of at each other, but the dog obviously can't communicate. Very well done. Like, it's just a really original concept.
It's a pretty cool little movie, considering it was a big studio movie and it just kind of faded away and it's kind of forgotten about.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's great, but I think it is a very watchable movie. It has some interesting ideas. It brings some interesting ideas to the table.
Yeah.
When it comes to werewolves, the only thing I kind of was iffy on was that I'm not really keen on movies where the dog is the main hero in it, because they did that with the Watchers movies too. And I'm kind of iffy on that.
Yeah, I usually am too. I didn't mind it in this one. I'm not sure why. And I also don't really like kids in movies either, where the kid's kind of a central character as well. But didn't bother me in this one. I really enjoyed this one.
The one thing I'd like to mention about Bad Moon that I think is funny is that there's a scene in it where they're watching Werewolf of London on TV.
Yeah.
Him and his nephew are watching it, and they're talking about, you know, the standard silver bullets and all that stuff. Yeah. And Michael Parry's character is just laughing about it. Like, oh yeah, right. You know, and I thought that was kind of a neat little wink at the camera for a wink at the audience for us from Eric Red. And I really think Eric Red did some pretty cool movies. And
he did.
I'd like to see some of his other stuff. He has Cohen and Tate, which is like a hitman movie with,
have you seen that one?
I haven't. I'm really interested in
it. Yeah. I mean, since Shout Factory put it out again, I think it was Shout Factory. They put it on Blu-ray. But yeah, I've been reading a lot of good stuff about
it. And I remember really loving Body Parts when it first came out in 1991. And Near Dark is still one of my top five vampire movies of all time.
Without question,
So, Bad Moon, worth checking out for sure.
Totally.
And you can go buy a 4-pack DVD that has what in it?
Wolfen,
Bad Moon, and
Coma.
And Body Snatchers, the 1993 Abel Ferrara.
Right, yeah.
So that's for $10.
Yeah.
So two of the movies you've talked about here, plus two other pretty decent movies for $10. Get on it, people.
We'll take those royalties.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I guess, do you want to do one or at all?
Well, I thought I'd talk about the goofy side of werewolves, which we already kind of touched on when it came to Werewolves on Wheels and that. But you remember there was a... There's always been, in werewolf movies, there's always been a comedic side that's come out here, there, and everywhere. Like 1957's I Was a Teenage Werewolf.
Yeah.
With Michael Landon from Highway to Heaven. And that was like kind of a drive-in quickie from American International Pictures and producer Herman Cohen about a teenager who transforms into a werewolf and, you know, causes rampage. There was a sequel to it called I Was a Teenage Frankenstein that came out the same year. And that's interesting because they took the, they added comedy to it and like kind of like humanized the werewolf for the high school crowd, which they also did.
It was a big exploitation movie. Right?
They also did that in 1981 for a movie called Full Moon Fever, or Full Moon High, sorry. Full Moon High, directed by Larry Cohen.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Who made Q, The Winged Serpent, and It's Alive, and movies like that. And I've never seen it, but it's the same thing. A teenager and his father go on a trip, and they get to Transylvania. They get bitten by a werewolf. He comes back, goes back to high school, starts transforming into a werewolf. It's played for comedy. He's on the football team, and there's things like that.
I just watched a trailer. I thought it looked terrible.
Which they kind of did again in 1985 when they made Teen Wolf with Michael J. Fox. This is before Back to the Future became a huge hit that same year, and it's the same thing. Gets bitten by werewolf. It runs in the family, which I thought was interesting because there's never really been a thing in werewolf movies where it's passed on from generation to generations that I can recall. And it's pretty sad if Teen Wolf is the originator of this. Yeah. But, you know, it's a fun little movie because it's him turning into a werewolf at inappropriate times in school. Like, there's a scene where he's, like, surfing on top of a van. And it's like, the werewolf, he's really cool. He wears sunglasses. There's, like, 80s music blasting in the background. He fucking turns into the wolf for a basketball game and is fucking slam dunking and shit all over the place.
Well, he was in his... Michael J. Fox was his prime when Teen Wolf
came out. I mean, an entertaining movie.
Oh, yeah.
Stupid, but entertaining. Yeah. I mean, they made a terrible sequel with Jason Bateman a couple years later. It was a TV... Like, it was a cartoon show.
Yeah.
And then they fucking... MTV came along about 3 or 4 years ago and fucking shit out some...
I heard the TV series isn't that bad.
I don't know, man.
No, it's not something... It totally doesn't appeal to me at all. But I have heard it's not that
bad.
But
Teen Wolf's about yucks, not yucks.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yucks as in ho-ho, not yucks as in, oh, gross.
And they've made it into, like, it looked kind of Twilight-y.
Yes.
And, TV series doesn't appeal to me at all.
So, I mean, there's those goofy ones that are in there. And it, I mean...
Another one that I did when I was looking into this stuff, My Mom's a Werewolf. Do you know that one?
Yeah, I know of it, but I haven't seen it.
And, I mean, not really a lot. Directed by Michael Fisher, who directed...
Fisca,
Death Spa, and Dead Time Stories.
Yeah, and the thing about that one is I remember the book when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was originally a young reader's book
that was
made into a movie. That's the only thing I really remember. It's one of those Crown International late 80s movies, and it pops up all the time on those Mill Creek multi-feature packs.
Oh, does it?
Okay. Yeah.
It's written by Mark Pirro. Do you know him?
No.
He did a low budget movie that I did know about.
Pirro, Death Row Game Show.
He did that, but he also did a movie called Curse of the Queerwolf.
Oh, yes.
Where instead of turning into a werewolf, people turn gay.
Ooh, baby. And there was also a Polish vampire in Burbank, which he made.
Exactly, yeah.
He's an interesting, interesting fellow.
Yeah. So, yeah, there was a lot. There was that run of comedies that came out.
But then I found that, again... Werewolves kind of died off after the 80s a little bit. And then they kind of resurged again at the beginning of the 2000s.
Well, there was the one in the 90s that I think should be mentioned is Wolf.
Yeah, with Jack Nicholson and Michelle Pfeiffer.
Have you seen it?
I saw it a while ago, and I remember not being impressed by it.
Yeah, I've never seen it. I was just kind of like Jack Nicholson.
I think it's fairly dry, if I remember.
Yeah, and Mike Nichols directing a horror movie. I was kind of like, eh. But I think it's probably worth looking at. Because it is a pretty great director and a pretty great cast.
I would probably watch it if it was on Netflix Instant or something.
Yeah, that's the only one I'd mention in the 90s.
But then we hit the 2000s, and that's where I kind of saw a resurgence. We see a resurgence happening, right? Because
in a good and a bad way.
Yeah, in a good and bad way. A good way is...
Yeah, let's talk about the good way.
A good way is Ginger Snaps.
Yeah.
Which is a Canadian low-budget movie from 2000.
Yeah.
Directed by John Fawcett.
Right.
And starring Catherine Isabel...
Emily Perkins. And Chris Lemke or something.
And
like
this
that.
Is interesting because it's about these two sisters who are obsessed with death.
Yeah.
So they're always like staging these death scenes and taking photographs of them and everything. And they end up going, they're having a midnight walk through the park one evening on a full moon.
Yeah.
And Catherine Isabel's character gets attacked.
Ginger.
She gets attacked by a werewolf. And the thing that I found interesting about this is the reason she got attacked by the werewolf, which I'm not spoiling for you if I tell you this, is that she was on her menstrual cycle.
Right.
And I've never seen anything like that before. Yeah. Like, you know, beasts being drawn to the smell of blood is nothing new. You know, like Jaws, sharks, things like that. Yeah. You know, other creatures, they're drawn to the smell of human blood. But for it to be menstrual blood kind of adds this morbid kind of twist to the werewolf legend for me. Like, I was just like, that's kind of cool, but kind of fucked at the same time. Yeah. And, you know, and the movie goes from there with Ginger trying to, live her high school life, live with being a werewolf while her sister tries to take care of her and kind of...
But she changes, yeah, right?
Like, she does change.
She, like, not just into a werewolf, but mm-hmm.
She becomes kind of slutty and, stuff like that. I mean, she becomes more... I guess in touch with her feral side, I guess you would say.
Her animalistic.
But her sister's like knows something's up and is like trying to stop it. I mean, it's been a while since I've seen Ginger Snaps, admittedly, but I remember really loving the movie.
Oh, I did too.
Like it was such a fresh take on werewolf movies because they had kind of dried up.
Yeah.
Like we said, and there was two sequels to it. There was Ginger Snaps and Ginger Snaps Back, like Ginger Snaps 2, Ginger Snaps Back.
It was called, there was Unleashed, I think it's called. Ginger Snaps Unleashed, and then there's Ginger Snaps Back, The Beginning.
It's weird the titling in that, because in Canada, it's called Ginger Snaps 2, Unleashed, and then it's called Ginger Snaps 3, The Beginning.
Okay.
And I saw both of those in theaters, if you can believe it.
Wow.
And 2's more following Ginger's sister, and where she gets put into an institution, and there's werewolf stuff in that. And 3 is interesting because it goes back to colonial times
in Canada,
yeah, and follows werewolves being in like this wooden pioneer fort.
It sounded kind of like a siege movie,
but it's got the same
siege movie,
sort of,
yeah,
and it's got the same actresses in it, which I thought was interesting. Yeah. So that's an interesting series to check out. The first one is out on a collector's edition from our buddies at Scream Factory.
Yeah.
And so
our buddies.
They're our buddies because they put out everything we want. But you should pick that up for sure. I mean, that's a very interesting movie. What's another one from the 2000s you could think of that?
Well, I think if we're talking about siege movies that are werewolf movies in the 2000s, we should talk about Dog Soldiers.
Yep.
Which is directed by Neil Marshall, who is one of, our favorite up-and-coming directors. I don't know what direction he's going now. Last I heard, he's doing Troll Hunter or something, but...
Yeah, and he did episodes of that show Constantine.
Oh, okay.
And he's got some anthology one coming out called Tales for Halloween or something that he did a bunch of other people.
So this is Neil Marshall's debut, and it's a werewolf movie about a group of army soldiers in Scotland, I believe, and they have to hole up in this farmhouse because they're being attacked by werewolves. So it's a siege movie with werewolves trying to get in. And I remember when I first saw Dog Soldiers, I really dug it. But again, it's one of these ones that just hasn't really stuck with me, and I've just never really gone back to. And so thinking about it now, I'm kind of like, I wonder if it was as good as I remember. Because Neil Marshall's done some pretty awesome stuff since.
Descent is one of my favorite horror movies of the last 10 years.
And Doomsday is one of my favorite B movies of the last 10 years. So has Marshall just gotten so good that we've forgotten about Dog Soldiers?
Soldiers just like a rough get started kind of deal.
Yeah, I think it's probably pretty good. I really wish I had had the chance to revisit it before we recorded this.
I didn't either. I just remember The only things I really remember about it was two specific scenes. I think there's one scene where the one guy's trying to hold his intestines in. Mm-hmm. And then there's another scene where the werewolf actually grabs a shotgun or a machine gun off one of the soldiers guys and uses it, which I thought was pretty fucking awesome. Mm. And those are the only two scenes that stuck with me from the entire movie. So I would really like to revisit it though. But I mean, I think everyone should watch it just because Neil Marshall is such a interesting talent to me, because he's making the movies he wants to make.
Yeah.
And they're all basically inspired by the kind of movies we grew up with.
Exactly. And I remember the creatures being really impressive in that one too. I wasn't like, they're not CG. Mm-hmm. They were practical as far as I know, and they looked good. I mean, I wasn't looking at it like, oh fuck, look at that stupid werewolf. I remember being, holy shit, look at that fucking werewolf. So I think Dog Soldier is definitely worth looking at. Scream's putting it out this year, I believe. Yep. It's like it's been delayed a few times.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why, but so I think I'll probably pick it up when it comes out again.
I'll buy it.
Yeah.
But I'm just finding it weird that the shift of werewolves is we're getting some serious kind of werewolves in the last 15 years. We're getting some really cool, serious kind of werewolf movies, but they're also shuffling it into this realm that I'm not agreeing with. No. We're getting into the Twilight realm where there's vampires versus werewolves and, you know, things like that. And there's also that Hemlock Grove show that Eli Roth was a producer on that I really hated the book and couldn't get into the show, where I watched one episode and that was it.
I watched one episode of Hemlock Grove too, but I think it's worth watching. I hated the first episode, but from what I've heard, and I actually watched a bit of like a couple of trailers for it while I was preparing for this, and I think it looks pretty fucking good, man. Like, I don't know. I think I'm going to go take another look at that.
I didn't like the novel. That's my thing.
Okay.
So I don't know if they stray from the novel and make it more cohesive, because the novel is very confusing.
Yeah.
And I found the first episode of the show to be kind of confusing too, because they tried to add too much to it.
I thought it was terrible, but
I mean, so we'll
I think
see.
It might be sticking with, I think it might be worth sticking with. And I think season two really ramped it up. I usually try with series to watch a full season before I give up. Because I find with a lot of series, usually seasons two, where it picks up.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I just was like, fuck it, after one episode. But,
well, so was I. I was just like, ugh. I can't get into this. I think it's because Eli Roth directed it and I had higher expectations for it.
Exactly. But
could have been.
Anyway, I just wanted to give that caveat, because I don't know if it's totally worth writing off. But from what we've seen, yeah. But I just think this might be one where it might get better, but we might be totally wrong because neither of us have seen it.
Well, I don't really have any ones that I want to delve into with any great depth left. Do you have anything that you want to do? Because I figured what we could maybe do after you throw out what you have there is we could just go through some of the titles I wrote down here in brief that I think are worth mentioning.
Sure. Yeah, there's a couple more I'd like to mention first. Another one I watched for this is called Big Bad Wolf.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Have you seen that?
I haven't.
Okay, it came out in 2006, directed by someone named Lance Dreesen. I don't know him at all.
No.
But it's starring Chloe Moretz's brother, Trevor.
She has a brother?
Yeah.
Well,
Trevor,
I guess
Dale Moretz.
I guess I wouldn't know this because she's in every fucking movie and he's in nothing. So,
anyway, he's kind of this geeky guy who he's trying to fit in. He's trying to like pledge for this fraternity. So he goes with this cool friend of his. This really cool. He's this geeky guy that's got the kind of badass.
Why is he cool? Why is his friend cool?
Because she's this like kind of badass chick that like rides a motorbike.
Oh, all the geeky
leather.
Guys fucking score these cool,
you know,
chicks.
And she's not his girlfriend, but she's like his best friend.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Anyway, he drags her up with all these like two frat boys and their bimbo girlfriends up to this cabin, and it's a stepdad's cabin.
I'm offended you use the word bimbo.
They are bimbos.
I'm not offended. Go ahead.
Well, one of them's bimbo. Anyway, the one that gets naked isn't the bimbo though. Anyways, I
weird.
Digress. Anyway, they go up to the his stepdad's cabin, and pretty much what happens is this wolf comes out and it kills all the frat boys and the girls, and turns out that Moritz's stepfather is a werewolf, so you're spending the whole movie trying, he's trying to prove that his stepdad's this werewolf.
Oh, it's the boy who cried wolf all over again.
But it's really good.
Really?
So the werewolf, the stepdad's played by Richard Tyson, who was he was the bully in 3 o'clock High.
Oh, that guy's awesome.
And he is awesome at this because he's just like the swaggering asshole.
I love 3 o'clock stepdad
High. Who's like a werewolf, but he's in human form most of the time. But it's just kind of this interplay between the two of them. Well, you know, the kid's trying to prove that the stepdad's this werewolf, but the stepdad's trying to like try to conceal his own identity, but he's a real asshole about everything. And it's got really good effects. It's really gory and it's really fun. And I really enjoyed it.
It's not CG?
Nah, no. It's practical. Sold
right there.
And it's good and gory and fun. And I really dug it. The only thing that threw me off is the werewolf talks. And I was like, you got to be fucking kidding me. But he's just an asshole werewolf.
Really? It was like he's walking around going, hey, you, hey, prick, come here for a minute.
He's just this asshole. He's like raping people. He's just like this total prick.
So this werewolf's raping the chick. He's like, oh, yeah, you like that, huh? You like that, huh? Since they're talking?
Yeah, pretty much.
Fuck. I think I might have to check this out.
It's totally worth checking out. And I don't know why I think I was just poking around on this and I saw it on some top 10 list. I'm like, what the fuck is that? I've never even heard of this movie. So I checked it out. It really worth seeing. So it is comedic, but it delivers the goods. It doesn't get boring. Kind of a spoiler that it does that turn. Like, it looks like it's going to be a Cabin in the Woods movie, which it's not. But great one. Hmm. Totally enjoyed it.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah. Another one I'd like to mention is from the 70s. It's called Werewolf Woman. And this one, kind of when we were talking about Howling 2, I just thought of this one again. Because this is an Italian movie, or a Spanish movie, directed by Reno de Silvestro, who basically, he's only done, like, the only thing I could note down was a SS movie he did, Deported Women of the SS. But it's this woman who turns into a werewolf, a la Sybil Danning in...
Wait. It's called Werewolf Woman, and she turns into a fucking werewolf?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
She totally does. And so it's been re-released on Blu-ray recently, but last year, by Raro Video. It had been put out in DVD in the 90s or 2000s by Shriek Show, and they fucked up the aspect ratio. So there's a proper release of this coming out. Everyone was up in arms back in the day because some pubic hair was cut out of the frame or something.
Oh, shit. No wonder. So, were you one of those assholes?
No, I didn't raise a stink about it. Huh. But of course, if it had pubic hair, I was a little pissed off. But, but it is kind of note because it is. I found the Italians, like, they usually jumped onto genres, especially particularly the zombie and the serial killer slasher genres, but they never really jumped onto the werewolf genre. So this is a werewolf movie from Europe, and there wasn't a lot of them.
Well, the only other werewolf movies I can think of from Europe are those Paul Naschy ones.
Of course, the Paul Naschy ones, yeah. And we can't go without talking about the Paul Naschy ones. So Paul Naschy played, he was Spanish,
yeah.
And there was a series of movies. They were called the Hombre Lobo movies.
And I've actually never seen any of these.
I've seen one of them, but I'd like to see more. So he played a character named Waldemar Daninsky, and he played the same character in all these movies. I'm not sure if there was 12 or 11 of them, because it's in dispute whether the first one actually got made or not. Some people say it was, and it's a lost film. Other people say it never even got finished. But anyway, there's at least 11 of these. So some of the more popular ones that people might know of, and they've got a bazillion different AKA titles. So I'm just going to list them, the sort of main ones I know. One's called Frankenstein's Bloody Terror, even though it's a werewolf movie. And that one came out in 1968. Other ones are The Werewolf versus the Vampire Women. That was in 1970.
Is there vampire women in it?
What's that?
Is there vampire women in it?
I don't know.
Because you said the first one didn't have Frankenstein in it, so wouldn't it be
ironic? I
didn't
say it didn't have Frankenstein in it. It just, it's a werewolf movie. Weird that it's a werewolf movie called Frankenstein's Bloody Whatever. In 1972 was Curse of the Devil, which I know Anchor Bay put that one out. That's the one I've seen.
Sensing a trend.
And then in 1975, there was The Night of the Howling Beast, a.k.a. The Werewolf and the Yeti.
Ooh.
So, those are kind of like, so he did a whole bunch of these movies, but those are kind of the more popular ones. But Nashi is like, he's kind of like Lon Chaney. He's like forever associated with being a werewolf.
He's the Spanish Lawrence Talbot.
Exactly. The other ones I think we should bring up just briefly, Full Eclipse from 1993 with Mario Van Peebles.
That's like an HBO movie.
Kind of interesting, though, because it was werewolves, like this sort of cop task force made up of werewolves who were like kind of vigilantes.
Which is like last year's Wolf Cop.
Yeah, so kind of a twist, kind of like Wolf
but
Cop.
But more serious.
This was like this like serious task force of like vigilantes.
Wasn't that directed by Douglas Hickox?
Anthony Hickox.
He made like Waxwork and things like that. Yeah. Sundown, The Vampire Retreat, which is another interesting take on the vampire legends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Hickox was cool. Like and Waxworks, I really love those movies, which also had werewolves in them, I might add.
Yep.
But those were really cool movies. I really wish Scream Factory would get their hands on those.
I like his movies.
Yeah.
I even think Sundown, I haven't seen it in a while. I thought it was interesting because it's a vampire western.
Yeah.
And then Waxwork, like you said, brings back all the classic monsters in this like mishmash of fun where they're all wax figures kind of come back
those
to life.
Those are fucking awesome movies, man.
Yeah, those are fun movies.
Yeah, but I wanted to bring up Full Eclipse just because it's another one of those kind of interesting spin on the subgenre. Why don't you talk about Wolf Cop for a sec while I'm...
Well, Wolf Cop is... I haven't seen it, but I know it's just kind of... It's a Canadian-made, low-budget movie about an alcoholic cop who becomes a werewolf and uses those werewolf powers to fight crime. Looks very campy in the same vein as like Hobo with a Shotgun and things like that. So I'm kind of interested in it. So I'll probably check that out sometime in the future. There's been like a little run of newer movies, like 2014 werewolf movies that I'm interested in. Because the other one I want to mention that I'm really looking forward to seeing is called Late Phases.
Yeah.
Which is directed by Adrian Garcia Bogliano.
Yeah.
And he did Penumbra and Here Comes the Devil. And this is his first English language movie. And it's pretty cool in concept from what I can tell, because it's about a Vietnam veteran, he's in his 50s, I believe, and he's blind. And he comes to this small town and there's werewolves there and he has to kind of fight these werewolves without having vision.
It sounds awesome.
It looks
really excited about this one.
Kind of violent, but also serious enough that it should bring some interesting twists to the subgenre. So I'm looking forward to that too.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. It also stars Nick DeMisi, and he's kind of an up and coming indie guy. He was part of the creative team behind Mulberry Street and Stakeland.
Okay,
and so I think it's kind of cool that he's in it, and it's also got Ethan Embry and Lance Guest, like a couple blasts from the past.
Lance Guest
and
Tina Louise,
Ginger from Gilligan's Island.
I didn't know she was still around.
I didn't either.
Wow.
Is there any other newer ones that you're looking forward to?
Those are the only ones that I can think of.
There's one called Where. Have you heard of that one?
No.
Or maybe it's Ver. W-E-R from 2013. And it's by, so this could go either way. It's directed by William Brent Bell, who did that Devil Inside.
Oh, okay.
That one, that nun thing with the sticking out the tongue.
Yeah.
So I don't know if this is going to be a good one or not. Starring AJ Cook from Final Destination 2.
Mm.
But the trailer looked pretty cool. It looked like another interesting spin on it, but it could be a shite show for all.
Could be. But I mean, how about we just talk about some titles that we aren't really that familiar with that we feel like should just get quick mention and head towards our wrap up here. What do you think about that?
Sure.
So I couldn't go without mentioning a movie called Company of Wolves.
Of course.
From 1984.
Yeah.
And it's directed by Neil Jordan and stars Angela Lansbury from Murder, She Wrote. And the main thing I remember about this movie, because I have not seen this in a long, long time, is that The poster art was fucking amazing.
Yeah.
Because it was a man with his head tilted back with a moon in the background, and the wolf was actually coming out of his mouth.
Yeah, it's an awesome poster.
And this is a famous, famous video box. I don't remember if this scene happens in the movie, but I sure as fucking hope so, because it's so awesome.
I think it's even more intense in the movie.
And it's a very twisted take on Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah.
Which I think is interesting, because there are a handful of werewolf movies that are a take on Little Red Riding Hood, but this is probably the first one.
The thing is, the only thing with this one is, because it was in the whole effects boom, where we were having Rob Bottin and Rick Baker like facing off against each other with their transformations.
Yeah.
I think the transformation in this one maybe isn't as epic as what audiences have come to know with The Howling and American Werewolf. So I think it might be a disappointment that way. And also Neil Jordan's a real stylish director. Yeah. So I think it might have been a little maybe too highbrow for us horror fans.
Yeah, I think that's what the main thing I've heard about it is, that it's very seriously toned and thinking man kind of, I guess.
And then with maybe not so good effects, but you're right, huge Little Red Riding Hood influence in this
one. And that poster, man. That poster. I'm all about that poster.
That's an awesome poster.
And then another one that I'll bring up quickly is when Stephen King decided to enter the werewolf
fray. I thought we were going to skip it again.
with Silver Bullet.
We skipped it in the Stephen King episode.
Yeah, it's based on his novella, Cycle of the Werewolf. And it's about a young boy played by Corey Haim, who's wheelchair bound. And he starts to suspect that the priest in his small little town may be a werewolf and may be killing people and turning people into werewolves in town. He has to try and convince his crazy uncle, played by Gary Busey, and his sister, played by Megan Follows from Anne of Green Gables. And this is a PG-13 werewolf movie, I believe, or maybe it was restricted. But I remember the Carlos Rambaldi effects were pretty decent.
Oh, was it? Rambaldi?
There's a pretty cool decapitation near the beginning of this movie where a homeless man's decapitated by a wolf. There's a dream sequence where everyone in the church parishion turns into werewolves and Corey Haim sees this, and that's kind of cool. And I think it's an interesting idea having our young hero being wheelchair bound.
Yeah.
Even though unfortunately he's in a wheelchair called the Silver Bullet, which his uncle, the crazy Gary Busey, has souped up to be like super powered, like motorbikey, which I kind of thought was
just talking
stupid.
About it makes me not want to see it.
It's not a great movie. By no means is it a great movie.
Yeah.
I mean, Stephen, we have to mention it because it's Stephen King.
But we didn't even mention it in the Stephen King.
I'm mentioning it this time.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I have no desire to watch this again. I watched the trailer in preparation for this, and even that
turned you off?
Well, I don't like the, maybe because it's Corey Haim, but I'm just, the whole wheelchair thing kind of bugs me.
And there's two other movies that I have written down that I just wanted to bring up before you can go on to your list of whatever you want to mention here. I wrote down Cursed from 2005.
Why?
There's a reason for this. It's directed by Wes Craven.
Yeah.
It's written by Kevin Williamson, who did Scream. That there has people who like Scream, which isn't me.
Nor me.
Creaming their jeans.
Yeah.
And I hated it. I saw it in theaters and I want to walk out because it had that smirky, smarmy teen vibe to it that the Scream movies started in horror movies. It had a werewolf flipping people the bird. It had pretty poor CG-assisted werewolf effects. And it managed to somehow make Christina Ricci unappealing to me, which does not happen very much.
Wow.
So I wanted to mention that.
I don't remember anything about this movie. I remember her getting in a car accident and climbing around on a hill or something.
Yeah, like,
that's all I remember.
Any movie that makes me not find Christina Ricci appealing is a bad movie indeed. But the only other movie I have written down is one that I've really been curious about seeing and I might get around to seeing one day. And my reasons for this are not simply because it's a werewolf movie, but simply because I know it's going to be a train wreck. And it's a movie from 1987 called Monster Dog. And it's, Alice Cooper as a kind of mercenary type who hunts down werewolves. He's dubbed in the movie. They didn't let him use his own voice. And it's directed by Claudio Fragasso, who made Troll 2, which is a fucking nightmare of a movie to watch.
Yeah.
So I've always been curious about it. I've always looked at the video box since I was a kid.
Yeah.
I'm going to make this happen someday soon.
Wow, monster dog, eh?
It's going to be a monster of a fucking dog.
I think I have the VHS upstairs.
It's going to suck, man. It's going to suck.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know. I watched the trailer for it. I don't know. It's kind of a werewolf movie, but I think it's like this werewolf that like lords over these dogs that do his dirty work.
It's kind of wolfeny.
I think it's wolf. I think there's actually a werewolf, but I think the werewolf's like...
He sits in this fucking throne waving his hands at these fucking German shepherds. Yo, go do my bedding, bitch. Come on.
But yeah.
I don't know why my werewolf just talked like he was a pimp from a blaxploitation movie.
That was totally weird. And but considering it's Claudio Fragel, so I'm sure it makes a whole lot of sense.
Oh, yeah. His plots make more sense than Lucio Fulci.
I don't think I have a lot more to mention.
I'm not trying
to
piss off Fulci fans, by the way. His movies are pretty rad.
I'm just trying to look through my list here. I mean, obviously there's going to be a few that we've missed because, you know, it's pretty hard to cover every single freaking movie that's coming.
And you have to remember, when we go into these episodes, we decide on our topic maybe like 1 or 2 weeks out.
Yeah.
And then we try and cram in as much research and as much re-watching as we can. And there's just sometimes too much for us to get to.
Well, and it would be too much for you to listen to also. Yeah. We don't want to be talking about every movie. I mean, these are kind of the ones that we feel are sort of the greatest hits.
Yeah, yeah. Not so greatest hits.
Yeah. There's two more I'd like to mention. One really briefly is called Werewolf in a Women's Prison.
On that title.
It came out in 2006, directed by Jeff Leroy, who does a lot of low-budget movies and kind of fun low-budget movies.
The guy who made Bungalow of the Living Dead?
I'm not sure.
Oh, okay.
I just wanted to bring it up just because...
It's got a rad title.
And we do like these mishmashes, kind of like Werewolves on Wheels, where they mix werewolves and a biker movie. This is a werewolves and a women in prison movie.
See, and as you'll find out in a future episode, me and Josh have a great appreciation for women in prison.
Yes. And I will say, I watched the trailer for this, and it looked gory as hell and like a lot of fun. So I am going to watch that one. I unfortunately just didn't have time to watch it before this. And the other one I wanted to mention is just going on a little bit of a tangent from werewolves. I wanted to mention...
That's not allowed. I did not do that earlier in this episode.
It's not. It's a were-cat movie, actually.
What?
Cat people.
Oh, okay.
Which... I just thought, I don't know where the hell else we'd throw this in under a subgenre, because it's kind of its own thing.
Well, it's shapeshifting.
It's shapeshifting, and instead of people turning into wolves, they're turning into panthers.
Yeah.
But I dig this movie. This was directed by Paul Schrader, and I think this also came out in 1981 or 1982. 82. So this was, again, in the early days.
Big studio movie, too.
Yeah. And starring Malcolm McDowell, Natasha Kinski, John Hurt and Annette O'Toole.
And I know a pretty sweet David Bowie song.
Excellent David Bowie song. And especially when in the beginning of the movie, in the opening credits, Bowie just sort of hums along, and it's really cool.
You remind me of the Babe.
What?
What Babe?
But anyway, with Cat People, it's a remake of an older movie, a valid movie called Curse of the Cat People. But I just thought it's another interesting take on werewolf lore,
mm-hmm.
because they're turning into panthers, but it's the same idea.
Yeah.
You know, these people are turning into these monsters, this time when they're getting sexually aroused.
Yeah.
But it's a very cool movie. It's got some really cool transformation scenes, a lot of Natasha Kinski naked.
Yeah.
A really pervy turn by Malcolm McDowell. And Scream Factory put it out.
Yeah,
so
you've talked about it in a previous episode.
Yeah, we talked about
episode.
It in like, what have we watched?
Yeah.
But I just thought this, if there's any place that this should go, it's in this one, unless we talk about pervy Malcolm McDowell roles one day and have an episode about those.
Oh, God. We could do a double feature of Malcolm McDowell, Klaus Kinski episode. That would be as pervy as they possibly get.
Yeah.
But I think that it's interesting that from the titles that we've talked about today, how you can see kind of a shift in the werewolf subgenre in just the tone of them. Like, because there's always going to be those comedic takes on them, but it's weird how they started out, like, that subgenre started out strong in the 40s. Like, there was a lot of them, like, with the universe and that. And then it just kind of faded away.
Yeah.
And then it didn't really reemerge until 40 years later in the 80s, like we were talking about. Because, you know, there was scattershot werewolf movies in the meantime, but they just didn't seem to capture this thing. Like, the thing that appeals to me, like I said earlier about these movies, is that whole tortured, cursed aspect of everything, mm-hmm. where, you know, you're not in control of anything, and that you're changing in a way that's making you do these terrible things to people. And, you know, it's just, it's an interesting concept. I find it way more interesting than, you know, vampires. And I definitely find it way more interesting than zombies. And I just think it's cool because it's like meshing together two things that I like, which is, you know, that whole angsty kind of shape-shifting element with nature run amok in a loose way.
Yeah, totally.
Because I love nature run amok too, and we'll talk about that in the future.
Yeah.
But I'm just, you know, it's interesting to talk about these movies, and then you've turned me on to a few here that I'm going to check out, and hopefully you guys have been turned on to a few as well.
Yeah.
But if we missed anything that you think is really pressing that we should check out, just let us know. Hit us
Absolutely.
Up on, go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/GBW podcast and, you know, let us know what we missed. Let us know if there's anything you want to recommend to us that that would probably be really cool and appealing to us.
Yeah. Yeah. And while we're at it, like, what would be the top three werewolf movies if we were going to recommend to people?
American Werewolf in London.
Yeah.
For sure. Probably the 40s Wolfman, 1941 Wolfman.
Yeah.
Just because of its history and trend-settingness.
No, totally agree that those two.
And for me, I would have to say it's kind of hard to peg a third one because there's so many out there.
I'd probably go with Ginger Snaps just to have, because that way you can have one from each of the sort of runs. Yeah.
Ginger Snaps is good. I also really, really enjoyed Wolfen just for its different take on it.
Yeah.
So I'd say definitely if you want to, remember that 4-pack Warner Brothers thing I was talking about with Bad Moon and Wolfen? I think you should buy it. I think people should go buy it.
So why don't we just do a top five and throw fucking Bad Moon in there too?
Yeah. I wouldn't put it in top five.
Or maybe The Howling. Maybe The Howling. I mean,
I wouldn't put that in top five either.
Yeah. Okay, we'll stick with the three, and we'll throw in Wolfen as an honorable mention.
There you go. There you go. So as always, if you guys want to contact us, you can hit us up on Twitter at GBW Podcast or at Video Graveyard. I've already given you our Facebook address, but if you could go on iTunes and give us a rating and maybe a review, that'd be greatly, greatly appreciated. Otherwise, we are out this time. This is us. We're done. Hopefully you don't go and turn into a werewolf and howl at the moon and all that kind of stuff. And if you do, take pictures. My name is Chris. With me is Josh.
Thank you so much.
And we will talk to you later.
Ow, ow, ow!
Oh, see? No, that's not as good, man.